I'm Kirsty Rice, and welcome to Two Fat Expats, the podcast about living a fat expat life. We're here once again with lots of ideas and suggestions to help you live a fat expat life. We're going to show you how to fill it up with goodies until it's bulging at the seams. Today is an extra special podcast, our second book club discussion, and the very first with a real life expat author. We've also got some fantastic podcasts to share, social media and film to talk about. So let's get to it, shall we? Let's go and say hello to our serial expat, Nikki Moffat. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Kirsty Rice. How are you?
I'm good. What's it like in Hamburg?
Well, the sun is shining. Well, it was actually a few minutes ago. The weather changes quite quickly, got to be on it. And today is Australia Day, so that always makes me a little bit homesick. I know that there are some discussions and issues around the date of Australia Day, but the day itself makes me miss the summer, really, the beaches and the warm weather and the tennis and the cricket and watermelon.
Yeah. Look, I don't think I had really factored in. I was obviously here for Australia Day last year, but I must have been sick and chemo and radio and stuff, and I couldn't even tell you what Lizzie and I did on Australia Day last year. But this year it has been very apparent to me that probably, you know, 90% of Australia goes to the beach on Australia Day. And they really do, don't they?
I think they do.
Yeah. So we obviously live in a beachside kind of place. And this morning I walked down because we had, I had a house full of people yesterday and I had lots of people sleeping over. And this morning I sort of got up and went for a walk on the beach and it was quite grey to sort of start off the day. And I was thinking, wow, gee, there's mounts of people here. I didn't realise as the day went on, the sun came out. And I had to, long story short, go and deliver extra things for my child who'd forgotten stuff down at the beach. But I got there and it was jam-packed, like ridiculously jam-packed, like five times busier than normal. And then I saw on the news that, you know, it was impossible to get a car park for people that were at beaches in the city. And, you know, the beach was just shoulder to shoulder. And embarrassingly, I guess I've been away from Australia for a long time. I can't remember it being like that years ago, but it's very much like that now.
Yeah, well, I guess I reminisce that maybe it was always like that, but it reminds me of summer. It's just another marker on the summer calendar for me.
Yes. And as you had sort of touched on, it is a very controversial date because there's a hashtag in Australia at the moment, the change the date, because people say it's not a date to be celebrated for our Aboriginal people. And I think it's, you know, a lot of people refer to it as genocide and that we need to change the date. And so there's a lot of discussion. Our current Prime Minister doesn't think we need to change the date. But a lot of people within the Aboriginal community and non-Aboriginal community as well think that, yeah, we just need, if not everybody's happy, it's not a party. Do you know, you have to.
Yes, and I do, and I did remember. So this morning on my Facebook page I shared one of my favourite poems by Dorothea McKellar, My Country. I said, you know, it's not perfect. No country's perfect, but this reminds me of home and I just hope keep it a little bit less controversial. But anyway, yeah, so that's me. But I am in here in Hamburg. So this week I've hosted lunch for some friends.
How'd it go?
Yeah, it was fine. I just, my one trick pony, I just got out my mini quiches and whipped them up. We've had some play day and I've driven my car a few times. Went to German lessons. It's all happening. It's all happening in Hamburg.
Do you feel like you've made some new friends or are you building on current friends at the moment?
Oh, no, I'm reinforcing right now. I'm in reinforcement mode. And then I'm going to branch into tribe building. So,
yes.
I'm just letting it grow organically. Yeah, that's how we're going today. Yeah, and then the Amazon man just rang the bell just before we started recording and dropped off some soundproofing tiles. So I've got my next Pinterest project that I can undertake.
So is he a German Amazon man from the German Amazon?
I don't think there's an Amazon river, but okay, I know you're talking about Amazon websites. So yes, he is a German Amazon man. I think they DHL do their deliveries. But Amazon has a very similar website in Germany to the one it has in the US. So it actually sells you a lot of things, whereas the Australian website doesn't have as many sort of other items. It's more focused on, I understand, on books and
yes,
other things like that. It doesn't have, you know, like...
That is all about to change, they say.
Anyway, yeah. So that's where I'm at. Where are you at, Kirstie?
Well, I'm kind of in between two lives at the moment. I feel like I've been in Australia for a very, very long time because I have been in Australia for a very, very long time. So I had to come back here in the first sort of week of December to get my big girl off to, you know, France for her school trip, and then it was fine because it was only sort of a matter of a week or so before my other children arrived. But they left, you know, in the sort of second week, beginning of the second week of January, and so I am starting to feel quite sort of titchy about it. Do you know, like, it's just, I feel like I've been away from them for too long, and I always refer to it as geographical schizophrenia, you know, where you sort of, you're in one place and thinking about another. But I think it's weird because I've been here for so long, you're really cementing yourself into something. Do you know, you get to the stage where you've seen friends four or five times instead of just two or three.
Yeah.
And it all starts to feel very, very normal, and you realize that your house is quite stocked to stay. You know, and it's I'm not feeling that holiday vibe, you know, that I had. And I never do. It's a weird thing, but the minute my husband leaves, it's almost like the holiday's over because it doesn't feel the same, do you know, because you're not with all your family. But yeah, it's just, but the other weird thing is I just feel a million miles away from my Qatar life. We've had a lot of stuff going on with the kids, and you know, we've had a few kid issues with schooling and things that I just haven't been there for, that Greg's really had to look after without me. And yeah, it's just, and I don't want to sound, I definitely don't want to complain, because I know that this, to me, 10 years ago, I would have thought that this was bliss, you know, to be able to split yourself between the two locations, to be able to have a house at home. Do you know, that's what I really dreamed of. I used to really dream of, well, one day we'll have this house and I'll be able to go back and forth, and wouldn't that be amazing? But I think what I hadn't really thought about is that once you start sort of heading off all the time, you become a very unreliable friend. And, you know, I know there's a whole life going on in Qatar without me that I'm going to have to do some serious work to get back into, because I'm not part of it, you know. I'm not that I do any of these things because I work, but I think an example is, you know, if everybody meets on a Thursday to play canasta, you're not about to get invited on Thursday for canasta because you're not really reliable and you're not there.
Let me just make a note, start canasta nights.
Thank you. But, you know, I had this conversation with my mother-in-law because she's actually in Qatar now, looking after the kids with Greg, which is why I've been able to sort of stay back and be with my big girl, my elder daughter. But, you know, my mother and father-in-law used to kind of space themselves between two locations. They had a place at the beach and a place in the city. And she was saying that now that she's on her own, she really feels like she needs to choose, because she's got to start making an effort to get involved with definite friend groups, you know, and get in a routine. Yeah. And it's so true. We have to do that. You can't keep flitting back and forth without it being really disruptive to everybody.
Well, yeah, or you've got to make real effort. You've got to make the effort, as opposed to when you live somewhere all the time, it's almost effortless after a while because you get routines and people call you and they remember you're there. Whereas yes. you've been away for 3 months when you go back and you'll have to remind people, hey, it's me, it's Kirsty. But I wouldn't worry too much. You'll just have people jumping on you in the supermarket and inviting you around for coffee, so don't worry.
I think I'm going to have to do something like that. I really think I'm going to have to do the coffee morning or do something, you know, to get back out there again, because I have, I've been in Qatar now for nearly 7 years, and I have seen a lot of people come and go, and I think I need to almost get back out there and make some new friends as well.
Okay, well, that's exciting news for the people in Qatar. Kirsty Rice's friendship list is no longer full. She's open. I just say that because expats, as you know, who live somewhere a long time can get very jaded and say, okay, I'm shut yes. for new people.
Yes.
And we have talked about that before, but yeah. we don't want to dwell too long on this. We could do, maybe a whole episode on it. But let's...
No, but it is. It's true. We have talked about this before, you know, that episode of Seinfeld. Where they say, I'm shut, I'm full. I'm not recruiting right now. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, well, I think I've definitely got to start recruiting again. But I just have to get back there and get in amongst it. And I said on the Four Kids 20 Suitcases Facebook page today, I literally now I'm looking at my kids on Skype and I'm absolutely aching to touch them. You know that feeling? That feeling when you just look at them and you think, oh my God, I just have to be near you. I want to touch you. I want to smell you. I want to touch your hair. Do you know? I just want to be near you.
I want to check for knits.
Yes.
Make sure you're washing it.
Yes, and I just feel that way desperately. But at the same time, it's just the weirdest feeling because I'm obviously here with my big girl and we're having a great time where I'm actually getting to pick up her friends and drive them places and be in the car and chat and giggle and, you know, be part of her life. All that stuff that when she's here and I'm not here, I feel guilt about of I haven't met that person's parents, do you know, or I don't know that place you're talking about, or I don't know where you're going because I haven't physically seen it. Whereas now I feel like I'm doing all that stuff and I don't want to leave her, but then you're wanting to go back. It is the weirdest thing. Yes. Anyway, let's talk about the book. So,
yes,
The Disobedient Wife, written by Annika Milicek Stanley, Milicek? How do you say it?
I think it's Milicek because her husband is Bosnian.
Oh, so wow.
I am guessing. Yeah, he's from Sarajevo. Yeah. So I am guessing, I mean, that's how you say it. The interview, it was so interesting interviewing her. I mean, she has just lived in lots of places and done lots of amazing things. And anyway, we'll get to that in a minute.
No, but tell me about some of the places she has lived.
Right. So I think she left the UK when she was 21 and she has lived in Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, India, Burundi, and obviously Tajikistan. And she says it with a J, Kirsty, so that's how you pronounce it, Tajikistan.
Yeah, that's so annoying. It means my friend Hamish was right, and I'm going to have to tell him he was right.
And then her husband works for the UN. So there was one stage where he lived in Lebanon and they lived in the UK. And then they lived in Egypt, and now they live in Italy at the moment. So lots of places. You know,
yeah,
and just really interesting places.
Just incredible. And so the story that she's written, The Disobedient Wife, and I think we have to be really careful because we want to encourage people to go and read the book because it is amazing. So we're not going to give too much of the book away. Like, this is really meant to be talking about the idea of the book and the author and the expatness, I guess, about how both of these things, both with the story and the author. But it was fascinating, I thought, because it really looked at the story of Harriet, who was living in Tajikistan with her husband as an expat. And then now I noticed, because you did the interview with Annika, and this is always great when you're reading a book and you're pronouncing something some way and then you find out that it's completely different, like Tajikistan. But how did you say the character, the Tajiki character? Is it Nargis or Nargis?
It's Nargis. Nargis.
Okay.
Yes.
So Nargis was a local woman who was working for Harriet, the expat. And so it really looked at their two different lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And almost, and it's interesting, and you'll hear in the interview that Harriet, the Harriet character wasn't going to be so big, but she actually became equal to Nargis. So the story was more about Nargis when Annika first wrote it, and she rewrote it several times. And the expat part of it and Harriet's part is what appealed to a lot of the people who read it, who discussed it with us and sent us messages.
Absolutely. And yeah, I find that really interesting that that change was made, that it was going to be about Nargis, because one of the things that Annika did in this book was she had Harriet writing a journal. And to me, those pages, which you knew were Harriet's journal because they were dated almost, you know, in a Bridget Jones diary, but in a miserable sense, but they had, she was counting how many minutes she had left in Tajikistan at one stage, wasn't it? Tajikistan, sorry. So she was counting the days, hours and minutes that she had left, and it was in italics so you could see that it was her. But I loved those journal entries. I thought her journal entries were fascinating, like horrifying, but that was the bit that kept me going, you know, through the book. I was quite fascinated in what Harriet, I guess, her truth.
Yeah, and I think I said at one stage, you know, some of the things, the conversations that she has with her friends, in inverted commas, and the thoughts that she thinks, you kind of cringe at them, but you think, you know, if you're being really truthful, then some of those things you may have thought yourself at some stage, but you look at them written down, you go, oh, that's just wrong.
Yeah. Oh, look, I thought the relationships with the friends was really sad because they weren't really even her friends. Do you know?
Yeah. And I wanted to ask about that because I guess Tajikistan, I have no reference point. I mean, I have lived in places that are very accessible, where there've been a lot of people, not necessarily all always expats, but a lot of other people around. But it sounded that you had to live quite a different life to the local people if you read the book. And I guess that probably for you, that would be similar to Libya in a way, your time in Libya.
Yes, very much so. And a lot of what she wrote about living conditions and, you know, trying to find, and I have to be fair on this, I lived in Libya in 2003. So I think people who lived in Libya before the Arab Spring probably, life, you know, there were more groceries coming in and there was more shopping and there was more accessible. It definitely is not the case now, from what I gather of what's going on in Libya at the moment. They're back to how we were in 2003 because it's really hard to get products in and out of Libya. But I identified very much with that, about the conditions of that. You know, things just disappeared and you didn't see them again, and, you know, getting powdered milk from strange places and whatever. What I really struggled with, though, was those friendships, because for me, in the really tough locations, I have had the strongest friendships with women, where we've really supported each other and looked after each other. And the way those women spoke about local people around them, you know, with no thought or feeling, I almost found it a little hard to believe. And I'm sure, obviously, Annika has seen this in her expat life, that she's written about it. You know, I've read other interviews of hers where she's talked about that people have contacted her to say, yes, I've seen that and I've heard that. But for me, on a personal level, I just couldn't imagine hanging out with such revolting people.
Well, and also the way Harriet talks about them is that, you know, there's some point in the book where she says, she's writing in her journal, and one of her friends Veronica has come to say that they're leaving and she's so excited, and no one's excited for her because they're all still there and they're not leaving.
Yes.
And it says, as Veronica talked, my fondness for her dissipated. She will be gone soon. What is the point of her now? We perched on embroidered Lebanese cushions, trying to keep the happiness from her from leaching out of our voice.
And that's tough, you know, because I understand the point of, I'm miserable that my friend has just announced she's leaving, and I cannot imagine how I'm going to cope here without her because she's my lifeline and I adore her. But I don't understand at all the what is the use of her now.
Yeah. So now we're just going to turn off.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's just, it's very hard. Like, I just think, and some of the statements that she made in there as well were, at one point she said, I inhabit, which I thought was very interesting in an expat kind of way, I inhabit an imaginary world where the only people I can relate to are as rootless as me. We belong to a stateless state, an international diaspora. Do you say diaspora or diaspora?
I say diaspora, but I've said everything wrong so far.
Cut off from our origins by the changes that have taken place in our absence as much as by the relentlessly dull sameness of it all when we return, which I thought was kind of, it's interesting, but it's just so depressing. Like, if you think about it, you could look at it that way.
Did you spend a lot of your time thinking, gee, Annika really doesn't like expat women?
Well, I kind of did. And I asked her about that. You'll hear in the interview, I asked her about that. And she talked a little bit about it. I said, you know, she seemed a bit harsh on the women. She spoke about that. And I think, you know, when you hear about Annika and the way that she has lived in the places that she's lived in, not that she doesn't like expat women, it's just that she can see how it can become very difficult in a particular situation. So except when she's been on sort of maternity leave, she's always worked and had jobs in the locations that she's lived in, which she's been very lucky to do because of the kind of work that she does, and she's lived in places where she can do that kind of work. So I don't know, maybe, yeah.
Okay, so tell me about talking to Annika.
Well, it was hard to pin her down. She was very busy. She works with refugees in Rome right now. She has three children and, you know, and she's writing another book. So it was hard to pin her down, and you and I both tried, but your time zone didn't work so well. So I got to do a Skype call with her earlier this week, and I really enjoyed talking to her, and I found the editing of the interview very hard because I think everyone should listen to all of it. But that can't always happen. I interviewed her and I started off by asking her about her work.
Yeah, my husband works at the UN and for the World Food Programme. And I have worked for them as well, but I have a background in social anthropology. And so I was doing lots of assessment and evaluation and research kind of work. And then I moved into a more operational job, working for humanitarian organizations to actually implement projects. And then I was working with, I've worked with reproductive health and water and sanitation, public health, and rural livelihoods, as they call it, which is basically a very holistic way of working with people to assist them in all kinds of ways that will help all their different capitals. Anyway, it's now I'm actually working in a refugee center here in Rome as a fundraiser and program coordinator. And it's great. I like it. But it doesn't leave me enough time to write. So I am writing still. I have to juggle the writing with the job, which is difficult at times. Yeah, I have three children, but they're at school. So when they're at school, I have a lot of time. And I work from home 2 days a week. And in theory, my job at the centre is supposed to be from 9 to 3. So I have a bit of time for the writing as well.
Obviously, you lived in Tajikistan. But of all the places that you've lived, because you've lived in many, what caused you to base your novel there?
Really, because up until then, I'd written a lot of short stories, really for myself. And then when I was in Tajikistan, I had much more time because I had babies. So I was at home with them. And I was running some things from my house during those years. First a baby, mother and baby, like coffee morning thing. And then after that, a kindergarten, because I had quite a lot of space. And we didn't have an English-speaking kindergarten in Dushanbe. So I opened one with some Tajik teachers, and we had lots of, I met lots of nannies, Tajik nannies, and lots of different kind of people from all over the place, from all over the world, but also from very different backgrounds. I met missionaries, I met, that I describe in the book a little bit, obviously from the point of view of Harriet, who thinks they're all weird, and then from the point of view of Nargis, who quite likes them, you know. And then I met a lot of embassy wives, from America mainly, but also from other countries. And I found Tajikistan to be a really fascinating country because it's so closed off from the rest of the world. It's so difficult to travel there. There's no hotels. There's nothing. There's no infrastructure for a tourist outside the main city. It may have improved since I was there. I'm not sure because I haven't been back. But at that time, it was a very insular society, very cut off. I don't think we could use Facebook. We had only an expat English newspaper that was online that we sent to each other. There's nowhere to buy novels. There was no newspapers that weren't state controlled. TV was pretty much state controlled. We did have satellite TV, but only a few channels. And it just felt like a very interesting country from that point of view.
So the expat women that you speak about, the embassy wives, and were they people that you knew, or were they a combination of people you knew? Or
yeah, they're a combination. I mean, the book actually took me 4 years to write because in the meantime I had 3 children to take care of. So when I started it, I was pregnant with my third baby, and the other two are quite close in age. So it took me a long time to write it, and it was kind of, I wanted it to be how I wanted it to be. I didn't want to sort of finish it and then send it when it wasn't it wasn't good enough. And I had trouble actually finding interested people to publish it because they said it wasn't marketable because nobody knows about Tajikistan and perhaps nobody cares about Tajikistan. But luckily my publisher, I won this prize at the publishing house where I've got it published, and they really like it. And they said, no, we're going to publish this. We think it will do well. But yes, I mean, I know Harriet has this sort of slightly toxic relationships with these two women in particular.
Yes.
Yes. Who are very depressed. But I wanted to show sort of from the sympathetic point of view that it's easy to fall into this attitude when you're so isolated and you're in a place where there's really not much to do as an expat except get together and feel miserable. So,
but then there was Emma, who was very, you know, quite a jolly good sport.
That's true. And Emma is an example of many people that I met in Tajikistan. Very upbeat, very positive, but you know, she is kind of working as well, even if it's voluntary, but she's doing something outside sort of quite limited life.
Right. And that's the difference.
Which brings her in contact with Tajiks and with Tajik women.
So the disobedient wife was all the women? They're all disobedient wives?
I think that that's up to the reader, but for me, the point is that you might start off reading it thinking that Nargis is the disobedient wife because, of course, she left her husband. But you might come to the end of the book and think that Harriet is a disobedient wife as well.
And the woman that Nargis ran the shop with.
Oh, she's definitely disobedient. Yes. Definitely.
You write in a way that, I mean, you talk about the local Tajik where Nargis lived, her housing and everything in great detail. It feels very real. Did you spend a lot of time in those kind of places?
I did spend quite a bit of time in those kind of places because I knew Tajik women for various different reasons, and I went to some of their houses. But I mean, I have to say that Nargis's background isn't necessarily representative of everybody. I mean, many Tajik people do live in these high-rise Soviet apartments,
which is where she kind of moved to after she was in the refuge.
Yes, and I mean, they're much better. They're cold because they run on gas, and at the time there wasn't much gas, so people had to build their own little wood burners and knock holes through their kitchen walls to stay warm. It was a bit ridiculous. Many of them don't have lifts, and there are other issues, but they are considered to be better than a village shack you know. And in a sense, I saw lots of different types of housing when I lived there, because I met lots of different Tajik women from different backgrounds. Some of them had fallen on hard times, like Nargis. Others were doing okay. I was very good friends with my Tajik teacher, for example. But she actually lived in a house a little bit like how I described Nargis's, a bit better. You know, her kitchen was outside, and they lived all together in the house. But I also got very interested in what has happened with regard to the rights of Tajik women since the fall of the Soviet Union. And I think it's interesting that this cultural vacuum that the Soviets left has allowed more and more conservative elements to dominate. And this has been very, very bad for women.
And Henri, you based him on anyone in particular?
No, I didn't base him on anyone in particular. I had a lot of fun writing him. I don't know exactly why I decided to make him Belgian. It just appealed to me that then I could make him come out with French expressions and compare her to a bottle of wine, that sort of thing. I thought it was just funny to me. But he could have equally been British, to be honest. And at one point he was British, actually, in one of his versions.
He was.
And I think he was called Henry. But no, he's not based on any one man that I know. But I have, of course, over the years, I have met some expat men who are married to women much younger than them, and they do behave like that. And they do want their wives to be, you know, quiet and pretty and cook well and, you know, keep a good house. And that kind of annoys my feminist principles slightly.
Yes. So with the food, the book focused a lot on the food shortages and how, you know, there were lots of things you didn't have. Is that how you lived when you were there?
Yes. Yes, it is. So I used to stockpile. I describe Harriet stockpiling. We were all stockpiling.
Right.
So I had, a baby and a toddler. And I remember when we ran out of milk, and that was a pretty bad one, because there was local milk, but it was meant to be very dodgy. So we used to buy this packet milk from, I think it was from Kazakhstan, that was imported. For ages, one time we ran out of the packeted milk. That's one example. But yes, there were always shortages, and we were never really sure why.
No.
It just was, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember one friend of mine who used to bake bread all the time, driving around and around in the town, going to every single shop she could think of to try and find flour, because there was a flour shortage. I really liked bananas, so I didn't bake bread. But she was desperate. I remember driving around like crazy the whole day, trying to find any packet of flour that she could.
So you said it took you like nearly 4 years to write the book. What was the process that you went through? So you wrote short stories, but was there any other thing that prompted you to move to the longer form?
No, it just happened on its own, because I found that I had so much to say, and I was captivated by Nargis, and I don't know, I just really, really enjoyed the process of writing it. I didn't set myself any targets or deadlines. I was just doing it because I enjoyed doing it, and I wasn't working at the time, you know, outside. I was working very hard with the babies, but yeah. I don't know, I guess it just developed slowly. And because I took my time, I was leaving it for quite long periods. When I just got sick of it, I would just put it into my computer and not open it for a while, and then come back to it and then edit it. And in the final draft, I edited out at least 150 pages. And I'm glad I did, but it's funny to think of it now. It was so much longer, but it wasn't necessary. It was, you know, there were bits that were boring, or there were bits that were irrelevant, or there were bits that were actually too political. So I cut them out because they distracted from the main story.
I think I read in an interview something that it was a difficult niche. So there were a lot of publishers who thought it was a good book. Also, the sort of niche for expat and Tajikistan, they're two kind of settings.
Yeah, Tajikistan isn't really a niche, because there aren't any novels about the country. This is the first one, if you can believe it. There are lots of travel books about Central Asia, but there aren't really any novels about the modern-day republic, because local writers are so persecuted. So there was that problem. And then, yes, the expat niche. Well, I mean, most most people in the UK aren't that interested necessarily in publishing books in that niche either. Yes. So that was why, I mean, I did expand Harriet's character. Originally, her voice was much less dominant in the book. And then I realised, no, she needs to be a character equal to Nargis so that the person who's reading it can relate properly to the whole situation. Plus, I realised it was a nice balance between her and Nargis.
And it was probably the way that to get readers to understand the differences as well.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't... I think I wanted to be subtle about that. I didn't want to sort of make it really obvious. Look, you know, look how difficult it is for this woman and look how easy it is for her. I didn't want to sort of, you know, lecture people in that way. But I found that it happened on its own because Harriet realises as she gets to know Nargis more and more that actually she has so many privileges that Nargis doesn't have and she should make better use of those privileges. But that I think is something that maybe most people feel at some point when they're expats, especially if they're, well, particularly if they're living in a developing country.
We talked about before about the expat women that you wrote about, the Harriet's friends in inverted commas. So that it was quite harsh on the other ladies.
I know.
Or maybe that's because I was cringing on the inside because I felt maybe I'd said some of those things in my life.
Well, you'd be amazed at how many expat women write to me and men actually saying, I've had that exact conversation, which I think is great.
You move so much. Do you crave stability or do you crave the move?
No, at the moment I'm very happy to stay put because I'm enjoying this job that I do and I've met lots of lovely writers here and people in the sort of publishing, or not publishing, but, you know, bookshop owners and other people like that. I would quite like to stay here for a bit longer, but I accept that at some point I will have to go. And I don't really want to stay here alone, to be honest. I think that that would be quite difficult to be alone here in Italy. So we will have to move, but I don't know where. And the way things are now globally, it's getting more difficult to find somewhere with good security and decent schools. I mean, you know, everybody in the UN is looking for the same thing. We all have children. We all want the same kind of post. So we'll see. I might end up having to be on my own and my husband might have to go to an emergency for a couple of years, in which case I'll just have to deal with it.
So the disobedient wife, has it been successful in terms of your measures of success?
I think, yeah. I mean, I'm glad it was published. I'm glad it won. It's won two prizes. For me, the sales apparently are still happening. People are still buying it. Because my book is in a very small press house, they don't have the money to put it forward for big competitions because press houses have to pay thousands to put books up for the big national competitions and they simply can't afford to. But still, even so, it's word of mouth really, and things like this that get it out there. So I mean, I'm very grateful to you also for including it on your book read list.
It was suggested by one of our listeners, so you know, we chose it based on the suggestion of them. No, and we both really enjoyed it. So, Kirsty, what did you think?
Look, I loved hearing her talk about Tajikistan. I thought that was my favourite bit because it really did take me back to those times in Libya and gave me so many reminders of that way. I loved that it took her 4 years to write the book from a personal level because I think that's great. I would have been so disappointed if she said, oh, yeah, I just whipped it out in 3 or 4 months and it was done. It was good. I mean, you just realise what a brutal process it is when a writer tells you that, you know, I wrote it like this and then I wrote it like that and then I changed her this way. You know, there is so, so much to writing a book. You don't just sort of tap, tap, tappity tap.
Yeah, and then she took out 150 pages.
Yes.
Yes. I was like, oh, my God.
That's huge, 150 pages, isn't it?
Sort of 200 and something now. So it's like a third of the book, over a third of the book just got taken out.
Yeah, yeah.
In her editing process.
I thought one of the things that was interesting, because I have Amazon in Australia and you have Amazon in the US. Now, when I went to buy this book, I could only buy a Kindle copy, and I would have really liked to have had a paperback to have sort of carted around with me, you know, to the beach and stuff, because that's the one place I find the iPad doesn't really work, is down at the beach. But I couldn't. It was only a Kindle thing, whereas you're with Amazon in the US and you could buy a paperback if you needed to. So I think that's one thing to mention to people as well, that because I think you and I have talked about that before, and I just want to explain that to people. But yeah, I thought she was really, really interesting. What was going through your mind when you were talking to her?
Well, I was so overwhelmed by her togetherness and her skill sets.
Yes.
And I just felt I was stammering all the time. I was like, anyway, and you've kind of talked about this and the feeling of accomplishment. Like, she's obviously very bright, very energetic, very, you know, do you expect her to sound like that when you were...
Not at all. I thought she was going to sound like this really peaceful, you know, writerly, thoughtful person. And she was bursting with energy, wasn't she?
Yeah, and I just felt so inadequate. I always do when I speak to what we talked about, another kind of expat, which is the ones that, you know, work in NGOs and always doing something to help the world. I won't say save the world, because that sounds a little bit...
Do you know what's interesting about that? Because she kind of touches on those women, the difference between the two sets of women in the expat world in the book, because in the book she quite often sort of refers that Henri, which is Harriet's husband, who's the, I guess, the lead expat in that he's the one working, and they're there for his job. And she talks about the women that he works with and, you know, him going away with those women and whatever. But I thought there's a phrase in the book where she says, "The irony is not lost on me that Henry wants me to be friends with the women that he never would have picked for himself." And I was sort of like, ooh, like, is there that much of a divide?
Between
those expat women, because, you know, obviously we see it's that whole thing that works in any world where are you a woman who is working from home or choosing to parent full time or try and balance both and whatever. And that, you know, that's discussion is a regular, very Western, you know, discussion.
It's also about how other people treat you. Like, I remember clearly, yes, as anything, in my first 6 months in Hong Kong, I went to a dinner out with friends and there were people there that we didn't know. And it was a long table and we were sitting around these people. And a woman turned to me and said, you know, and what do you do? And I said, well, you know, we've just got here and I've got a baby and I'm not really doing anything. She turned around, did not speak to me for the rest of the night. And a year later, we went to another dinner with the same friends at a different restaurant, you know, sort of different mix of people. And she completely had forgotten me because I was not important to her at all. And she said, and what do you do? And I said, well, you know, I work and here's what I do. And engaged me in conversation all night. I couldn't. That to me is my clearest memory of...
Yes.
How even the sisterhood treat each other differently based on, you know,
yes,
in that world.
Yes, 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 yes. And, yeah, you do hear it. When you're a working expat woman, you will hear all those revolting, hideous anecdotes about, you know, ladies who lunch and when I come back in my next life, I'm coming back as an expat wife, you know, and... Yeah, you do hear people within the sisterhood who say, oh, God, she just needs to get a job, do you know, that sort of thing. I think I may have even been guilty of that myself, where I have met someone that seems like they've almost lost their rationality in an expat world, where their kids are at school full time and they don't have a job, but they become obsessed about, you know, a certain teacher at school or a certain issue that you think, well, you know, I don't think you would have time to think about this if you had other things in your life. I don't know.
But Harriet also talks about it in the book, in her writing. So she says, you know I sound like a spoilt princess, but I'm scared I'm going to become like them, those expatriate women with no home of their own, no roots and nothing to do but snarl at the poor maid. Shall I wait eagerly for monthly PTA meetings to pester beleaguered school teachers or live from one glittering charity gala to the next? Shall I give in and join a golf club? Will I greet middle age with an ever-enlarging arse and an undiagnosed drink problem? I mean, that's fairly harsh.
That is really harsh, and it's also a huge stereotype, do you know? Because I don't think I think that expat woman is a dying breed. I don't think there's that many women like that around. It's particularly the undiagnosed drink problem, and maybe it's because I'm in Qatar, I don't know, but I mean, I don't know any women that are drinking in the middle of the day in my expat world. Maybe if I was in Asia, yes, they would be, and maybe there is, but I don't know. It's just such a stereotype. Yes, there are some people like that, but please don't talk about expat women like that's the majority.
Yeah, but that is the stereotype. But sometimes you can own it. Like I say, if I have, you know, going to have lunch, I say, oh, would you like to come to Ladies Who Lunch? And, you know, it's just I'm making fun of it as well, but I'm still owning that I do it. I mean, one of my friends who came for lunch the other day, bought me a bag with a bottle in it, and I just thought, oh, it's probably a bottle of wine or something, and I put it on the side. And then that night, when I was cleaning up, I opened it, and it was a bottle of gin. And I said, okay, I'm owning it. You bring me the gin, I'm going to drink it. Sometimes the stereotype's okay for me.
Now, you've got another little quote here that you've written about Harriet.
Well, I just said, so it was actually something that Nargis was thinking when she was in the book. And it said, Harriet spent hours writing out application forms for the international schools, speaking with Kenyan estate agents and doctors, and scouring maps for landmarks on the computer. I need to get everything prepared just in case, she explained. To Nargis, it was as if part of her had already left, her soul flown ahead to new lands, blown overseas by the strength of her hope. So for me, that's two things. Like, in this situation, Harriet desperately wants out, and so there's a possibility of a move, so she's throwing herself into it. And the hope part of it. But I think it's for some people, when they have to move, that's the hardest part. You have to throw yourself into it. And I've most recently experienced it when I left from America. Like, people thought I was checking out, and I wasn't checking out. I just had to get my mind in a place where I could, you know, I had to join Facebook groups in Hamburg so I could find out those kind of things. But it's, and I had to think about that.
It's also your job to do that. And this is the thing we go back to is, you know, while you might be being the lady who lunches and getting bottles of gin to have for the afternoon, I mean, part of your role in your relationship with your partner is that is something you would do. If your husband came home and said, hey, I told you 3 days ago that we were thinking that we're going to move to Kenya, what you got cooking on that? And you said, oh, I haven't really thought about it much. I imagine he'd be quite shocked.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You're probably right about that.
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, that is the thing with moving countries and moving with children and whatever. The reason why it tends to be that one leads with the full-time job and the other one follows, and maybe that second person gets a full-time job a bit further down the track or a part-time job or whatever, the reason that happens is because they are spending their full-time hours facilitating a move and making that move successful. And I think that was what was interesting about Harriet's life too, was there was a lot of sitting around doing nothing, but they didn't talk about any of the ups and downs that would have happened in Harriet's day that, you know, would have kept her busy, like, you know, power going on and off and, you know, keeping the house sort of running and working and, you know, all of Henry's travel documents being up to date so he could keep going off skiing wherever he went. Do you know, like, she seemed to have a lot of downtime.
Yeah, more downtime than perhaps you would have.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, particularly with small children. Because, you know, I think it's easy to think of having help with small children that it all looks like Alice from the Brady Bunch, you know, but it's it's usually not quite like that.
No, and I think, look, she started out as not a very sympathetic figure, but I think by the end you're feeling a little bit more kindly towards her. And you know, I think that that's a good story for people who don't understand expat life, because a lot of people look at expats from the outside and go, oh, they're living that life. That looked pretty comfy. I might like a bit of that. But then, you know, the reality is not necessarily always super fantastic and fun. So, you know, I think the moving along and understanding, although it comes from her understanding Nargis and her life, so I guess that's where some of the sympathy comes from.
Yeah, and, you know, that was more the thing that I couldn't forgive of Harriet, was her naivety. And you know, we have all seen that. The person who's moved to the country and really hasn't done a lot of research on it, and they're desperately unhappy, and you think, well, where did you think you were coming? Do you know, what did you think you were arriving to? And I thought that was what made Harriet's character, I guess, so rich, in that at the beginning you were just thinking that she really was almost like a half-wit in her, you know, in her thoughts and naivety, that she had no clue how Nargis lived and she had no clue what was happening politically. She relied entirely on what Henri was telling her the political situation was, and, you know, the drugs and et cetera in Tajikistan. And then as she grew and got to see Nargis's life and her house and whatever, she suddenly, like you said, we started to feel more for her the smarter she got and the more educated she got about the country.
Yeah, and I also feel the whole thing about the other expats saying, oh, you know, don't lend money to your housekeeper, you know, they'll never pay you back. I mean, I really, that's a horrible part of that part of expat life, that people do have that. And I do belong to a group that I won't say in case I get kicked out. But there are a lot of people on there in this group in this country who constantly are concerned about how their own help might be ripping them off in some way and what can they do about it. I'm just like, you know, their life is just not, you know, just think about it in a bigger picture.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's the weirdest thing. I know before we moved to Jakarta, when we had never been expats, we went out to dinner with expats who for some bizarre reason told us, you know, that they wanted to tell us all about having staff, and which is not a conversation I would have now with people, but they were saying, oh, you know, and don't let them call you by your first name because they'll get too familiar with you. And you can imagine, if you've never travelled, you're just looking at these people thinking, you are hideous people. You are hideous, hideous people. But one of the things that happened, which quite, you know, often does in Asia, is we did lend everybody money and then we lent them again and again and again and again and again. And because, you know, we wanted to be kind, and yeah, there were a lot of deaths in the family, and there were a lot of people that got sick, and there were a lot of people that needed to be educated, but that was our choice, right? Because in the big scheme of things. But, you know, that you're right, there is this hideous conversation that happens where then people tell you that it's wrong for you to do that, and, you know, that you're upsetting the economy in some way by doing that, and, yeah, that you're being taken advantage of. And you hear all the horror stories of the things that were stolen and whatever, but the bare fact of it is you are living in complete luxury and sharing your life with people that are living almost in destitution.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And being able to account for that in some way to yourself is important.
Yeah.
So it was also interesting, I thought, hearing that this was the first book ever written about Tajikistan. Not that I'd ever seen another book about Tajikistan, but...
And not that I could say Tajikistan.
But it is quite interesting and to note that it is difficult to market a book about a country that nobody's read about.
Yes. And I thought she did such a spectacular job at showing you, like explaining the garments that women were wearing and explaining the housing. And I don't know about you, but my feet were perpetually frozen while I read this book. Do you know, like curled up frozen, because she did such a great job of explaining just how uncomfortable everybody must have been, you know, just walking from A to B. And she was just brilliant at that, wasn't she? Really good. Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine jumping in, you know, getting knee deep in, okay, I'm going to write about somebody else's country and somebody else's culture and get right inside it in the way that she did. And she did so incredibly well. Although we probably need to ask someone from Tajikistan if she did. They might say, no, she didn't.
We're just totally taking her word for it. So if you're from Tajikistan, give us a call.
Please.
And contact us via the website, Facebook, or our email to fatexpats@gmail.com and let us know if you've got a difference of opinion. All right, so overall, what were your thoughts on the book? Yes, no, recommend it to a friend?
Yeah, I would. I would definitely recommend it to a friend. I think I particularly liked it because I liked that expat side of it. And I found that really interesting that when you interviewed Anika, she was saying that, you know, it was really meant to be more of a book about Nargis, and that she added those bits in the end because I think, you know, like I said, they were the bits I really enjoyed. But that's being selfish on my behalf because I like to sort of see the dichotomy between their working relationship and living with each other and, you know, the kindness that they showed each other. And I just thought that was really interesting. I don't know. Would my non-expat friends find it as interesting? Yeah, I think the story, I don't know, what else is sort of, I don't know. What did you think?
Well, I think that's the thing. Like, I would totally recommend it to anyone I know who's been an expat because of the expat side of the story. But that's, I guess, why she had trouble finding a publisher initially, because if you're not an expat and that's a limited market in the world, will you find it interesting? Would you find it interesting to read about this? Is Tajikistan interesting enough for you to read about? I mean, she certainly brings it alive when you read it, but how would you actually, what's your elevator pitch? How do you sell that to someone? So pivoting then in recommendations, Kirsty, what recommendations do you have for us this week from social media world?
Yes, so social media world, I guess for me, my social media feed this week has been full of this whole Australia Day conversation. Every year there is an incredible Australia Day lamb ad, which I have always shared on the 4 Kids 20 Suitcases page every year, the minute it's come out. And it was interesting because I had, I think, maybe 4 emails from different Aussie expats who asked me why I hadn't shared it yet. And said, have you not seen it? You know, I always see it on your page and you haven't shared it. And I didn't because I felt really conflicted this year about Australia Day. I am
because
one of those...
Because of the change today?
Yeah. You know, I have not wanted to be a party pooper, I guess, in the past, because you look around and Australia Day is full of people barbecuing and down at the beach and having a happy time and celebrating Australia for the great country that it is, and it is. It's an amazing place to live. But I really, I think I've definitely made the decision in my head that, you know, if everybody's not happy with it, why are we doing it? Why can't we just change it? Because I really don't think Australians care if it's on January the 26th, like white Australians. I don't think they would care so much about January the 26th. I think as long as they had a day to go to the beach, they wouldn't.
In summer, yes, let's keep it in summer.
Yes,
I'm okay to change it.
Yeah,
I know there is a movement for May 8, and yes, I've seen that ad.
Yeah, no, I can't. But that May 8 ad, we have to share that because the joke about the May 8 ad is that it's May 8. And which is very Australian, but yeah, I didn't go as far as the hashtag change the date, although I did agree one of my favourite Port Adelaide football players. See how I just managed to sneak that in there?
Oh, there it is. Port Adelaide.
But today, one of my favourite Port Adelaide footballers, a guy called Chad Wingard, who is of Aboriginal heritage, shared a picture of a group of Australian Aboriginal men who were in chains. And he said, you know, nothing really to celebrate here today. And I thought, you have to sort of say that you don't agree if you don't agree. Do you know, like, it's an uncomfortable conversation. Yeah. And I know that I will have many friends that will say, oh, I wish you'd just get on with it, and why do people have to have a problem with everything and blah, blah, blah. But it's not right. If everybody's not happy with the date, we need to change it, definitely. So that's what my social media, so not really happy, happy, but that's what my social media has been full of. What about you? What have you been looking at on social
media?
Well,
I did share the Love ad, so call me.
It was a great ad. It was a great ad. It was brilliant.
And I said, you know, I acknowledge, but the ad itself tries to address the issue in a way that it says, you know, these people were here first. All you other people, you know, but they do say it in a way that we're happy for you to come, which is kind of, I get it.
Yeah, I have to say that just very quickly. So the ad, and we should share it so people know what we're talking about, but the ad starts with two Aboriginal people on the beach, and then the English come, and, you know, it's all very jovial, and because we see everybody coming from all the different nationalities and everyone's sharing lamb and everyone's having a barbecue and it's all happy, happy. Do you know, within minutes of that ad coming out, I had a couple of friends who posted, no, not funny, too lighthearted about a very real situation. And there were byproducts of that ad that came out.
I did see those as well.
So while, and I'm with you because I thought, oh, look at that, it's beautiful and it's inclusive and it just shows all the different people that came to Australia. But, yeah, it probably didn't really address the fact that so many Aboriginals were killed and raped and poisoned and that it wasn't a lighthearted moment in real life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, I accept that. And for anyone who's not Australian, we're very sorry about this whole conversation. All right, so, that's really it. I didn't have a lot of social media going on this week. I did listen to a new podcast, which was Mortified.
Have
you heard Mortified?
No.
So it's kind of like, you know how you recommended once, and I really enjoyed The Full Catastrophe, which was an Australian sort of stand-up storytelling. So Mortified is kind of not like that, but not like that at all. So it's people who wrote angsty, awkward things in their teen years, and then they have to prove that it's exactly what they wrote at the time, and then they get up and read it. So it's letters, or it's journal entries, or it's – I listened to one yesterday walking back from German class, and I was laughing out loud, and there were people looking at me strangely when I was walking along the street. And it was a girl who'd been a young teenager in Minnesota, and she loved Harry Potter so much, and she went online and she found Harry Potter homoerotic fan fiction. So she wanted to be the best homoerotic fan fiction writer online.
Oh, no. And
because these people were getting, and so she wrote her own version, and she read it out, and it was just, you know, it was a teenager talking about wands, and, you know, like, it was just it was just funny. But I've heard other ones too, where a girl writes about should she have sex with her boyfriend, and just written from the point of view of people who really
very awkward at that time of their life. So it's a good one, and it doesn't necessarily take a long time to listen to an episode, but it's, yeah, you can choose. There's loads and loads of episodes, and you can choose things that might appeal to you.
Right. Now, can
what about you?
Well, can you remember last week I said I just had listened to the very first episode of Homecoming?
Yes.
And I think I referred to Catherine Kinnear as Catherine Gunnier, so which would make me Gersty Rice. But so Catherine Kinnear is in Homecoming, and I talked about that movie that I really liked about, what was it, Friends with Money. But back onto Homecoming, I have rolled the whole six episodes this week. I loved it. I thought it was so clever in its production. Like, just
the editing is just crazy. Oh, crazy.
Isn't it? And just how, because you realise with the podcast, if you're making a serial where you're going to have, six different characters and they're all in different locations and different timing, and this podcast goes back and forth and back and forth in time, and they have so cleverly done it where, you know, little things like there's an aquarium in her office, so every time you hear the aquarium you know that they're back in her office, and you know that she works in a restaurant in her new life, so you know that now we're in modern time because you can hear the clink 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 of the restaurant. Like, just so clever. But David Schwimmer, as in David Schwimmer from Friends, I just found him so relatably awful for anyone who's ever had a boss who is full on and sweary and comes in and out of their life very, very quickly and, you know, just drops bombs and growls. I thought he was so good at that. He was so good.
I was a big fan of the passive aggressive behaviour.
Oh.
So the starting off all the phone calls they did, the starting off very calm. So just tell me what you're thinking. Just explain to me how this works. Okay, right. Then what the?
Yeah. Off his nut and always completely distracted by something else. And
yes, you know, that's clever. That's so clever in the script writing.
It was so cleverly done. I think Homecoming, like if we had more of those, it would be good. What was interesting though was I didn't get, so I've done the six episodes, and when I finished listening, what they do is at the end of each one, they give you a little behind the scenes of, you know, what was said or whatever. I didn't find them as fascinating as I usually do find things like that. I could have almost done without them. I just liked the actual show itself.
Yeah, but I think that's the part, that's their sponsorship.
Yes.
So that's how they're getting this. Instead of having ads or anything, that they have that as their sponsorship part of things, which is clever in a way, really. I think a couple of them I didn't listen to. I just got to them and I went, oh, okay, I'm done now. Moving on.
Yeah. Now, what have you watched lately?
Okay, so TV, I've been watching a new Finnish show. Now, it's not going to be for everyone, and I'm sensing that I've got a bit of a theme going this week, so I should probably check myself. It's called Casual. So think Weeds, but a lot more sex and bad decisions. So it's a story of a divorcee and her 16-year-old daughter, which is, of course, is the legal age for sex, so bring it on. Moving with her brother/uncle, who's a tech self-made guy who happens to write the algorithm for his dating company's website. So he writes it so he gets set up with all these people and then dates them. But I am enjoying it, which I don't know if that makes me a bad person or not, but it was honestly, it won't be for anyone. And you look at the decisions that everyone in it makes, bad decisions all the time. And it's called Casual because I think it's meant to be like looking for a casual relationship, like not. And so you look at it and I can tell you this, you watch a couple of episodes and say, oh, I like this, I'm going to keep going. Or you'll say, this is the most stupid thing I've ever seen in my life, I'm out. It's a Hulu original. So I think you have to get Hulu to watch it, but I don't know if it's anywhere else, but I'm watching it on Hulu.
Yeah.
So there you go. And I'm also watching Suits with my husband for the second time around. just because I feel like, you know, you and G always watch things together and I recommended that he watch it. And so every night after dinner, he says, let's watch an episode. So I say, okay. So I go, he says, but you've already seen. I say, I know, but I just want to be with you on the couch. So,
oh, look at you being nice to your husband.
Well, he's got me a car now.
What about reading?
Have you read anything?
I've almost forgotten what it's like to sit on the couch with my husband. My husband and I are solely, you know, on Skype. And I tell you, it is not, you can have wonderful, gorgeous, lovely moments of Skype with your husband and lovely texts where I sent him a text today because my daughter's here with a girlfriend and they went off to the beach and I said, I'm here alone. And he texted back, I'll be there in 5 or something. And it was like, oh, how sweet.
Aww.
And then in 10 minutes later, you're having a disagreement over the interior designer that he hasn't got back to you about which door he liked, because you could have said option A, B and C. And I sent that to you last Thursday and, you know, and him saying, well, there was no price on there. It's like, gee, that escalated quickly. We went from really being so yes, it's hard long distance relationships, aren't they? Long distance
they people. are. But it's nearly time. How long now? So one more week till you go back?
Just one more week. So daughter goes back to school on Tuesday and then I have some school stuff to do with her. You know, different meet the teacher nights and information nights and things. She's about to start her IB, so it's a yes. So yeah, because I know you were just about to ask me about what I was watched on television, and I really haven't, because this week has been a really big kind of back to school week where we've been going in. But one of the things that doesn't happen in our expat world is we don't buy textbooks because they are supplied by the school. And I think maybe that's a book thing too in the Middle East, if you just can't, you know, have books sent in because books are monitored in the Middle East. But none of my guys for the last 7 years in Qatar have had to buy any textbooks. Whereas in Australia, just this week, we've spent probably $700 on textbooks.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I was reading Facebook posts of other people saying they're spending like $500 and $600 on a couple of pairs of shoes for their kids, like going back to school.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I can't afford to live in Australia anymore.
Yeah. No, I bought her a pair of shoes and same shoes I bought her last year. And this is the thing, because, you know, you're buying them every year. And I was horrified by the state of her shoes at the end of last year. Horrified, because, of course, when you have a daughter who's a boarder, you don't see their shoes every day.
No.
And I actually said to her, are you telling me not one person looked at your feet and told you you had to clean your shoes? And she said,
we used to have shoe inspections in the boarding house on Sunday night. We had to take our shoes out.
She said on photo day they check, but photo day is right at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just haven't watched any telly. I had the neighbours over for dinner and a movie, and we watched The Big Short again because they hadn't seen
great
it.
Great movie.
Yeah.
Great movie.
Yeah. So our neighbours at the beach are 70 and 65. I'm just thinking how much they probably really don't want me to discuss that. But they wanted to have like a little information night of how do you download a podcast, how does an Apple TV work, you know, show me how that did. So we had dinner and a movie and did that and watched The Big Short. But yeah, great movie, really good. And of course, for those who don't know, it's the one about the subprime mortgage situation and the financial crisis and Lehman Brothers and etc. in the GFC.
Yeah, fantastic movie. Okay, so if you have enjoyed listening to us, if we've made you think about something or perhaps even giggle about something, then maybe you'd like to share us with your friends.
Yes, please share us with your friends. So, and I was thinking about this morning because we really do want to reach out to all of our expat buddies that are out there. So if you do have other expat friends that you think might benefit from all the different topics that we've discussed, we would really, really love it if you could share us and either leave us a review on iTunes or subscribe to the podcast.
Yes, we'd love that. And I'm hoping that I'm saying hello to listeners in Fiji, because I have a friend who's an expat in Fiji, and this week she contacted me on Facebook about something, and I said, well, any new expats, you have to tell them to listen to the podcast. She said, I don't know about the podcast. I was like, well, now you do.
And she called herself a friend.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, Siobhan, love you. And yes, you can contact us any way you like and send a suggestion.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Okay. All right. Well, Nikki, time for us to go. It is 11 o'clock in the evening here in Australia, down at the beach. What time is it for you in Hamburg?
It's 1:33 p.m. I'm just getting a little bit peckish. Might go down, wander down to the supermarket and get myself some lunch in the sun.
Nice. Okay. I will speak to you again next week.
Okay. Speak to you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.